politicians about the King of Kings.
Still I and I will go respire and stuff for I.
Hey, the ever-living King, yeah.
And spread them lies and propaganda around the world.
You politicians about the King of Kings.
Still I and I will go respire and stuff for I.
Hey, the ever-living King. For he's the power of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Divine Spirit who created all things. He's the natural mystic, he's majestic, he's prophetic, he's the ever-burning fire, he's life in all things. For he's the Lamb and he's the Lion, he's from Zion with the scepter in his hand, he's here to run all things. He's the rightful ruler of the earth and he conserves the all the book of life and all the destiny of all things.
They spread them lies and propaganda around the world.
You politicians about the King of Kings.
Be wise.
Still I and I will go retire a stuff for I.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to the debate, was Bush 43 the worst president of the last 50 years? You can hear this program at 96.5 in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterview.blogspot.com.
Jacob?
Just on LBJ, sorry to step on your well-deserved applause, Simon. Just on LBJ, the questioner asked, what courageous thing did he ever do? Just for starters, how about saying goodbye to the South, the Democratic Party, for generations, when he signed the Civil Rights Act in 64 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Johnson knew that would be the political consequence of that decision, and he did it anyway. To me, that's almost a definition of political courage. On judgment, however, I don't think Johnson does so well in Vietnam, and I think it's quite comparable to Bush. I think both of them were very poor. I think both of them were essentially unable to admit error, to recognize error, and to reverse error. And whereas Johnson, it was a slightly different story. And, you know, you get into sort of psychological territory here, but Johnson clearly didn't trust Kennedy's advisors. He had this long-standing issue with the Kennedy brothers, and I think he was getting some good advice from some of the Kennedy people, but I think he couldn't hear it because who was giving it. And likewise with Bush on Iraq, certainly the advice he got from Colin Powell at the very beginning not to invade Iraq was very good advice, but I think Bush was so blinded by his own motives, whatever you think they were, that I think he effectively couldn't hear that. And then he couldn't hear the very good advice that I said came from Bill Kristol, among other people, that the strategy was failing. And you know, it finally took just a series. It got to the point, really, where there was a total consensus that the strategy was failed and that Rumsfeld was failing. And I think Bush postponed change until there was absolutely no choice.
Okay, we're coming down to our last few minutes of questions. And I would like to make it a little bit forward-looking. And I just want to see if any of the hands up here have questions related to what President-elect Obama inherits from President Bush. Is anybody thinking along those lines quite clearly? And don't snooker me because I'll squash your question.
I think we all know that this motion won't really be decided here tonight, but it very well may be in 12 years, in 16 years, in 20 years. For those against the motion, can you paint us a picture of the world that would make your case?
Yeah. Iraq as a functioning semi-democracy in the heart of the Middle East as a example that would be a powerful antidote to the terrorist image of what the future ought to be like. Afghanistan stabilized, a continued decline in the ability of terrorist elements like al-Qaeda to threaten the West, a continued diminution in their ability to recruit, which incidentally I think you may have seen or heard about the new report out, which shows a dramatic decline in their operational capability and in their recruitment ability, and a world where the institutions that the president is seeking to leave in place, like PEPFAR and the Millennium Challenge, have revolutionized and changed America's pattern of foreign assistance to focus on results and transparency and accountability. And new institutions, whether it is the replacement for Kyoto with the G8 agreement this year to pursue a new international regime in which all the major emitters are at the table and all the major emitters are focused on energy efficiency and technological advances that allow them to clean the air and reduce greenhouse gases like we have done. We're the only economy. The last year for which numbers are available are 2006. There's only one industrialized economy in the world that grows that year and reduces the absolute level of greenhouse gases. It's the United States of America because of the approach we're pursuing. Okay. That's how it would look abroad.
We'll just add, I mean, just very briefly, make it a little sharper, perhaps. Look, from 1979 on, the Iranian Revolution and the disastrous Saudi Wahhabi decision to compete with the Iranian Revolution by exporting Wahhabi Islam much more aggressively abroad, and able to do that by the, obviously, oil revenues from the 70s, that they, once they were able to jack up oil prices in the 70s. Jihadism, Islamic extremism, terrorism has been, unfortunately, on the rise, doing some damage to us and huge damage, obviously, within the Islamic world and in the Middle East and in the greater Middle East and in South Asia. Successful U.S. foreign policy, which would have been begun by President Bush 10 or 20 years from now, would have reversed that. And I think we are on the cusp of reversing that. I think that is why the intervention in Iraq, the stabilizing of Iraq as a non-extremist, non-terror-friendly regime in the center of the Middle East, the crushing of al-Qaeda, and there's some very difficult things still to be done with Pakistan, but at least so far maintaining a decent civilian government in Pakistan while moving aggressively against the terror, the parts of Pakistan that have become terror, have been for quite a long time, terror-friendly. I mean, that reversing that would be incredibly important. That is really crucial to having a decent 21st century. And I think Bush has begun to reverse it. There's much more that has to be done. I trust that President Obama will do it. And secondly, nuclear weapons. It's amazing that we have had as little proliferation of nuclear weapons as we've had, many experts think, over the last 50 years. In retrospect, the Pakistani explosion of nuclear weapons in 98, and I was no more prescient about this than anyone else, was a huge moment, a very dangerous moment. And what AQ Khan was doing, unbeknownst to us and, you know, to others, was unbelievably dangerous. It made possible the North Korea program. It's made possible the Iranian program, accelerated the Iranian program. If we can prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, and that means preventing Iran from going nuclear, because if Iran goes nuclear, other nations in the Middle East go nuclear, and we're off to the races, then with a combination of nuclear weapons and possible terrorism and jihadist connections, it's unbelievably dangerous. So I would say Bush, I think, has done a pretty good job of beginning with that. I might have done a few things more hawkish than Bush, actually, in terms of confronting Iran, but, you know, he's got the Europeans together for the first time with serious sanctions through the UN Security Council, the United Front. He's handing Obama to put as much pressure as possible on Iran. If he can turn around the negative momentum on nuclear proliferation and on Islamic jihadism, we will have a much safer world. If we can turn it around over the next 20 years, if all of us can turn it around the world, if not, we're in a lot of trouble.
I'm going to turn one more time, and I want to hear the question before we go to the panel. I'm really looking for something that talks about the legacy that President-elect Obama inherits. We've had a question from you. Yes.
I, for one, am proud of the job President Bush has done to keep us safe and, in turn, the world. With that said, Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Weisberg, you speak in theories. What would you suggest that Barack Obama now do with Islamofascism, its threat to the world, and how is that different from the current policies that the Bush administration is employing?
Jacob.
I think Obama should focus, as he's appropriately doing, on Afghanistan and how to turn around a deteriorating situation there. I think he should figure out how to get us out of Iraq without Iraq falling back into the situation it was before the surge. I think those are things are compatible. I think they're possible. And, you know, much of this is so invisible to us that it's very hard when we say Bush has kept us safe. It's true. We have not had another terrorist attack in the United States. How much of that is the result of policy? How much is it the result of accident? We don't know that much about it. It's the dog that didn't bark. Would another president have handled it differently? I don't think so. But it's impossible to say.
Simon Jenkins.
I imagine the reason why there have been no more attacks in America or in Britain or in most of Europe is because of good policing on the ground, not because you've been at war in the Middle East. I believe in good policing. I think the cure to terrorism, whatever that precisely may mean, people blowing people up, is essentially frontline policing. Good intelligence, good espionage, good work on the ground. It's not by going to war against other states. But the phrase Islamofascism, so easily banded about from this side of the Atlantic, and I may say from Europe, when you travel in these countries, the relentlessness of the assumption that every Arab, every Muslim is a crypto-Islamo-fascist, and the evidence you give of it by going and invading some of their countries is the surest possible way to turn them into hostile. I cannot emphasize enough, these aren't normal people, by and large. They are people quite like you. They don't think, most of them, that they have a right to come and invade your country, close down Guantanamo Bay, do all the things they think you're doing wrong. There is now an assumption on the part of both your country and my country under Tony Blair, that we have in some sense a right to go and sort out their countries because they're not like our countries. This must be one of the great fallacies of the modern age. I hope Obama overcomes it.
Sir, did you get your answer?
Yes, I did. I didn't ascribe the term Islamofascism to
every... Can you begin again, please?
I didn't ascribe the term Islamofascism to everyone who's a Muslim or in that part of the world. I'm speaking about a specific group of people who have no intent but to do all Westerners harm. You've taken it beyond that, which is a great liberal elitist move to include everybody. To the answer to my question, how does Barack Obama tackle it, and what does he do different from the current policies to be effective?
I think that good relations with a country are more likely to get that country to suppress those elements within the country that are inclined to terrorism than bad relations with a country. That has to be true.
Bill Kristol.
I myself tend not to use the word Islamofascism. I just think it's a little analytically confusing. I'm not sure fascism is the best way to describe them. But the Islamofascists, if you want to use that term, the Takfiris, Islamic terrorists, have killed more Muslims than they've killed Westerners. And if you talk to Muslims, they want those people, to many Muslims, including many in Iraq, the greatest single victim. What country has been the greatest victim of the terrorists and of Al-Qaeda? Iraqi Muslims. And they are grateful now that they are going to be able to vote in 2009 in regional elections and in national elections and have a shot at not having a horrible dictator who himself murdered hundreds of thousands of people or not being dominated by ghastly Islamofascists, if you want to use the word. But I do think I sort of agree with the question in that sense. Precisely using the term Islamofascist separates, the reason you use the term is precisely to say that's not all of Islam, that's a little part of it, which unfortunately has been ascendant and if not resisted, will become more ascendant. And we need to help people resist it. We can't stand back and say, hey, none of our business. Afghanistan, Taliban takes over. So tough on you, you know. And Saddam, tough on you guys. And I guess in Sudan, it's tough. And other places, it's tough. And the Iranian civil society gets suppressed. And I guess we just can't say anything. And we just say, hey, that's the way they want to live in that part of the world. I mean, that is really what the council, I think, of these sort of realists who want us to think they are going to improve America's standing in the world. And in fact, will correctly call down condemnation on America, as has happened in the past, incidentally. One of the things that encouraged radicalism in the Middle East was the sense that we were standing aside and supporting dictators out of narrow self-interest. The single greatest harm we did to ourselves was stepping back in 91. We went in to kick Saddam out of Kuwait, which was correct. We needed to do so for strategic reasons. And then we abandoned the people of Iraq when Saddam turned on them. I don't think that's something to be proud of. And I very much hope, actually, that Barack Obama does not revert to that kind of foreign policy.
I'd like to quickly return to a question about why was America kept safe for 7 years? We were given two answers. One was luck, and the other was that any other president would have handled it the same way. Now, luck does come into play, but luck works when you have the kind of attitude that this president has, which is he's going to stay on the offense, so we fight him over there, and we're going to use every intelligence tool at our disposal to find out what they're up to. That is why we broke some of the plots that you know about publicly. You don't know about all the plots, but you know about the attempt to bring down Liberty Tower in Los Angeles or to blow up airliners simultaneously over the Pacific Ocean. We're able to break up those plots because this president adopted programs. Now, maybe Jacob is right that any other president would have pursued the terrorist surveillance program and the widespread use of our intelligence assets abroad to listen in on the enemy. I hope he's right.
What do you mean, Carl, by fight them over there? They weren't in Iraq. Unless you meant somewhere else by over there.
Well, first of all, again, I repeat, I appreciate your support for the war in Iraq at the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, I wasn't.
But let's be honest. He was supporting terrorists. This is a man who gave payments to terror bombers. This is a guy who allowed terrorist camps to organize in his country. The Ryson attack in London was launched from a camp in northeast Iraq. This is not a nation in which you can organize a terrorist camp without the central authorities knowing about it. Let me finish. Okay. In the aftermath of Afghanistan and taking down the Taliban, where did Zarqawi go for medical treatment? He checked himself into the Mayo Clinic of Baghdad. You don't get that unless somebody in the government government up top allows a known terrorist to seek succor and medical care in Baghdad. This was a bad actor. Now, did we think he had weapons of mass destruction? You bet. And I've got a sheaf load of quotes from people that you love, like Ted Kennedy and others, saying he did. He didn't. We now know that. We went in on intelligence that was flawed. But I would remind you of this. Intelligence gets it wrong both ways. In the run-up to Iraq, Muammar Gaddafi looked around and said, you know, the United States is serious about it. Britain is serious about this. I got problems. If they're willing to take out 25 million people and I take on Iraq with 25 million people, they're willing to take me on. And he coughed up his weapons programs. And Western intelligence found out they were wrong. They systematically underestimated how far along his chemical and biological programs were, which were weaponized, and how far along his nuclear program, which was way beyond what anybody in Western intelligence thought he had.
What was the price in attack in Britain?
Jacob, Simon, the rest of the panel, I want to respond to Carl's point, save it for your summary, two minutes.
Milk powder.
Simon,
thanks.
We're out of time on the questions and answers, but you have 2 minutes to sum up, and you can respond to the point there. I just want to thank all of you, and now we move on to the final session of the debate in which each of the panelists has 2 minutes to summarize the summary against the motion that George W. Bush is the worst president of the last 50 years. Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard.
As someone who grew up not far from here, it's embarrassing, frankly, that 83% of the people who voted think either that Bush is the worst president in 50 years or are undecided about it. Look, people don't have to like Bush. Half the country voted against him in 2000 and virtually almost half in 2004. If you're a liberal, you want to approve of his domestic policies. If you think that we'd be better off not having gone into Iraq, which obviously is a debatable proposition, you could be very condemnatory of his of going into Iraq, and certainly many people have criticized the way in which we managed that war from 2004 to 2006. There's no reason not to be critical of Bush, not to disagree with Bush, not to prefer Obama, not to have voted for Gore and Kerry. Most people in New York obviously have all those views. But to think that he's the worst president in 50 years is just silly. It's just silly, and it came out very well in the Vietnam discussion. I mean, are we being serious here? Vietnam was well run, and that was okay somehow, and you know, Westmoreland knew what he was doing. Of course, we lost 55,000 people. We lost a war. 2 million people plus died in Vietnam and Cambodia. It was an unbelievable catastrophe, which the region took a long time to recover from. It was a terrible humiliation, moral and political, for the United States. That's like Iraq, where we've lost 4,000 soldiers, where Iraq is now back on its feet, where we've won the war, where we've won the war and established U.S. credibility and a willingness to stick to it, even though we've made terrible mistakes, and where we're actually in pretty good shape with most of the governments in the region. I myself, being more of a democracy and human rights activist, am a little unhappy that we're so friendly with the governments.
Your time is up. 15 seconds, Grace.
With the governments in the region. But we are. So if we're in the real world, you can dislike George W. Bush, but you should be against this motion.
Summing up for the motion that George W. Bush is the worst American president in the last 50 years, Jacob Weisberg, author of The Bush Tragedy and editor-in-chief of the Slate Group. Jacob Weisberg.
Thank you. We've won the war in Iraq. There's something about this mission accomplished language that always makes me a little nervous. I think the damage in Iraq can be mitigated, but it can't. The war can't be vindicated as a decision. And this goes to the heart of our disagreement. Bill said at the beginning that Bush had bad choices. I don't think he had bad choices. I think he made bad choices. And I think things could have been different for Bush. I think he could have taken a different approach. And in fact, it was the approach he took when he was governor of Texas. He could have united the country and the world after September 11th. It would have given him an opportunity to be a great president. He could have reached out to the other party the way FDR did after Pearl Harbor. He could have kept his focus on America's real enemies as opposed to becoming distracted by Saddam Hussein. He could have compromised with Democrats on a whole range of issues, including climate change, expanding health care coverage, entitlement reform. He could have focused on protecting the free market instead of the interests of big business. And I think if Bush had tried to govern from the center right instead of from the far right, he would have been reelected by a bigger margin in 2004, and he would have been a successful president. But Bush was never up to the job of being president, and it's not a matter of lacking in intelligence. It's a matter of lacking character. Bush wasn't interested enough in policy. He couldn't tolerate challenge or dissent or disagreement. He couldn't open his mind long enough to consider alternatives or admit the possibility that he might sometimes be wrong. He let his righteousness and his arrogance and his anger get the better of him. And in the end, I think what's so damning about Bush and what does make him the worst president of the last 50 years is that these were things within his control. And to finish, I think we can say at this point that America's great nepotistic experiment is finally coming to an end. And as my colleague Simon Jenkins has said, it's finishing not just with failure, not just with rejection, but in global disgrace.
race.
Thank you, Jacob Weisberg. Making his summary statement against the motion that George W. Bush is the worst American president of the last 50 years, Karl Rove, former deputy chief of staff and senior advisor to George W. Bush.
I want to end with by accentuating the point that Bill made. But first of all, I need to say Jacob's comments can be read in his book, which is a piece of fiction. To believe that George W. Bush didn't tolerate strong people in his cabinet or dissent or disagreements is ridiculous. And to suggest that he's not interested in ideas is that peculiar form of Bush hatred that causes people to lose their rational senses about the man. And this president has been on the receiving end of this kind of attitude since the moment that he took office in an election that many on the left thought was made him an illegitimate president. Now, here's a man who the first person that he met with from the United States Congress was the ranking Democrat on the House Education and Labor Committee, George Miller. Didn't compromise with Democrats on No Child Left Behind, which he worked with Ted Kennedy and George Miller and John Boehner and Judd Gregg to get passed. Didn't cooperate and compromise with Democrats when we came out and endorsed wholesale large elements of the Joe Lieberman program for Homeland Security. Didn't compromise with Democrats when we came out for immigration reform. You know, that's just ridiculous. But I want to end because most of the circles around Iraq. Vietnam, I agree, better prosecuted than Iraq. We ended Vietnam in defeat, for which the families of 55,000 fallen heroes had reason to ask themselves whether or not that sacrifice had been made in vain. And we are coming out of Iraq with Iraq becoming a functioning, stable, semi-democracy in the heart of the Middle East, still fragile, but because of the surge, and a place today where we can see the moment that U.S. troops can come home with their honor and in victory, and for which the sacrifices of those who have died will not have been in vain.
Karl Rove, time up. Summing up, finally, for the motion that George W. Bush is the worst American president of the last 50 years, Simon Jenkins, journalist and columnist for The Guardian. Simon Jenkins.
Well, I repeat my view at the very beginning. I'm not here to be rude about an American president. I would just point out about Iraq. You cannot say something's a success when, as I saw last week, 2 million Iraqis are camped outside Damascus because they haven't got the nerve to go home to their homeland because the Americans are there. Two-thirds of all the Christians in Iraq have now been driven out of that country under America's aegis. Fundamentalism is far more rife in southern Iraq than it ever was under Saddam Hussein. Let's just get some facts here. However, let me come back to the original point. I had great respect for Bush when he came to power. I liked his courtesy, I liked his moderation, and I liked his concept of humility in America's power projection. I think, tragically, after 9/11, he allowed the politics of fear to get the better of him. He persuaded my Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to let the politics of fear aid his re-election campaign as well. The politics of fear is the most corrosive of all forms of politics in a democracy. Power at America remains a hugely powerful country. Power has an obligation of restraint. If you're the most powerful country in the world, your obligation is not to go over the top, to charge around the world, invading countries on the feeblest of pretexts. Your obligation is to show restraint. My America was always a country of huge self-confidence, belief in its ability to resist attack of any sort, and not needing to erode its own freedoms and those of other people in order to achieve that defense of democracy. I personally think that you've just elected a man who I've found from when I first read his book, a truly remarkable figure, on whom I think it is right to place great expectations. But he has got to recover from a terrible legacy in the world outside America. I still believe he will. I think you have a terrific future ahead of you, but you have been through an awful 8 years. Thank you very much.
We tend to judge who is the winner by who moved most positions, and in that case, I'll give you the numbers in a second, but the bottom line is that those against the motion changed more minds tonight than those for the motion. Before the debate, 65% were for the motion, 17% against, and 18% undecided. After the debate, 68% were for the motion, 27% are against the motion, and 5% remain undecided.
The war is over, the bastards won. Don't leave home without your lungs. They'll shoot your mouth off without a pause. Everybody has its flaws, but not you. You're perfect, and so many ways. If God made models of his best creations, you'd be on display. The war is over, hoping we can swim. Everybody's foundering, but not you. You're perfect in so many ways. If God made models of his best creations, you'd be on display.
That's all, folks.